of losing money in the stock market roller coaster? Frustrated with the government taxing you into oblivion? Worried about inflation? How do you prepare for so many financial uncertainties? Welcome to the show that will help you develop your game plan. The Financial Quarterback with Josh Jelinski. Josh is a noted financial advisor and president of the Jelinski Advisory Group, and he's here to answer your questions. Call into the show at 800-321-0710. 800-321-0710. Now let's kick off your financial future. Here's Josh Jelinski.
Hi, everybody. This is Josh Jelinski, the Financial Quarterback with Lobo Tigre. We're going to talk about, is that a legal name change? Is that your real name? I remember when you were Lewis James. Maybe you still are Lewis James.
You really want to start there? Okay.
I know. I'm curious. You know, that's all.
Short version is, yes, there have been some name changes. It's a long story. This is a chosen name, but it is my legal name. I can show you my passport.
Yeah, that's great. And so, how was your day? You seem like a busy day. Were you busy trading? Were you?
I gotta say, it's. I'm torn. You know, usually I have an angel and a devil on my shoulder. One's Rick Rule and one's Doug Casey, and they often trade places. Which one's which? But today, you know, gold's way up. We're looking like an all-time high close here. But I just had a new stock pick, a new gold stock on for clients, and one part of my deal with them is they get to go first. And darned if they didn't chase it. And so I'm looking at a significantly higher share price that I don't want to pay. That's not the deal I had. So the honest answer to your question is I'm ecstatic and frustrated at once.
That's good. So what are you researching right now that excites you?
Okay, well, let's go with the excited, ecstatic part. So it's early in the year for me to be patting myself on the back, but I did say earlier, last fall, actually, that my highest conviction trade for 2024 was going to be gold. I've actually modified that in light of the production difficulties the uranium producers are having. And so I'm actually more excited again about uranium as well, which worked very well for me last year. That was my highest conviction trade last year. So what I'm researching now is actually more gold picks. I like the uranium story. It's come back stronger than I thought, and we have a correction now. So there's opportunities. But, you know, the stocks there, at least the better ones, they're not out in the doghouse the way the gold stocks are. There are great gold companies that are selling at multi-year lows, 52-week lows. Some of them, especially if you price them in gold itself, are selling at near all-time lows. That's a crazy opportunity at a time where gold has shown enormous strength in the face of its usual headwinds, you know, interest rates, high dollar, that sort of thing. And going into a bullish scenario for gold, you know, I see, I mean, as we're speaking, you know, it would have sounded a little bit more pie in the sky, but I see continuing all-time highs, at least nominal highs, getting a lot more attention to gold. It's, you know, today as we're recording, it's funny to hear the mainstream types, you know, your Bloombergs and your even Yahoo Finance, it only seems to care about NVIDIA and Chipotle, talking about gold. So I see this as extremely bullish setup. So I'm looking for more great gold stocks to add to my portfolio before they take off.
Do you like gold, the metal, better than gold stocks right now, or both?
No, I'd say the opposite. I mean, I like them both, but they're very different things. First and foremost, you know, gold itself is an asset. It's a physical form of wealth. It's a financial long for which there is no short. So I like it a lot as congealed savings. It's an insurance policy in case of a rainy day, whatever metaphor you like. But that's very different from trying to make money. I don't buy gold because I think the gold dollar exchange ratio will go up. I buy it because it is gold. And if I ever need it, it will still be gold, no matter what happens. And I can use it in case of need. So right now, you know, it goes contrary to speculators' discipline to jump on something that just hit a 52-week high or an all-time high. And I do think it's going higher, but it's just, you know, it's like uranium a month or two ago. I was saying, I love it, but you know, it's just gone vertical. Let's look for a pullback. I would probably say something similar about gold. But to answer the question, yes, I like the stocks a little bit better right now because they haven't gone nuts. They've had a great day. But they're still relatively on sale. You can get quality producers and very prospective developers and successful explorers out there really selling, like gold was, a few hundred dollars lower.
So uranium, you like uranium too?
I do. I got a lot of heat from my fellow uranium bulls for what I just mentioned, saying, nothing goes vertical forever. It'd be a good idea to, look for some weakness, look for a pullback, a correction to create buying opportunities. My view on that, though, was before we got confirmation from Kazatomprom that not only were they going to cut their guidance, but they actually produced less in 2023 than 2022. This is a really big deal. This isn't just a company. This is the world's largest and lowest cost producer saying that it wasn't going to be able to meet its production goals going forward and wasn't even able to meet, last year's product or the year before its production last year. So this is a real, in my view, a game changer in the supply space. There's a very large chunk of expected supply this year just went away. At the same time, the number two dog in that space is, they're saying they're still ramping up production, everything's going to be fine, but they've also been experiencing troubles. And it's interesting, the biggest and the best in the space are having problems ramping up production. And so there's a plethora of juniors out there that are looking to do the same. I mentioned developers is sort of one of my favorite investment theses. And there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. And earlier, it would have been more reasonable to say, well, hey, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. The big dogs are ramping up production. The lowest cost projects are being built, not someday, some when, but now. These things are being built now. These are pounds coming to the market that weren't there before. So it was more reasonable before to be cautious about expecting uranium to keep rising this year. But now with all the troubles that they're having ramping up production, that's less reasonable. And, some of these companies are going to be forced to buy on the spot market rather than deliver from production or inventory. And that's a serious supply and demand shift. So I am more bullish now on uranium than I was just 2 months ago. But long term, I'm very bullish that the demand thesis going forward is just huge.
Where's the demand coming from? It's not coming from the U.S.
Yeah. Well, we have this new plant coming online in Georgia, so it's not entirely the case.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a lot of them being shut down, like Oyster Creek and California, and it's disappointing to me. I mean, I've always been a uranium bull back from like Rick Rule 10 years ago. And when they would say buy, what was it? URA and CCJ, and that one ETF did nothing for like 5 years, and then I gave up on it.
Yeah. So, no, I hear you. I understand. But, think about that. And the answer to your question is most of the building is happening in the East. Of course, BRICS countries are building gangbusters. China has scores of these things under construction and coming online. And in plans for ahead, they're just going gangbusters. But that doesn't mean the West this is actually another game changer here. The green agenda has come into play here. I mean, even that famous nuclear physicist renowned around the world, Greta Thunberg, was chastising Germany for shutting down its last nuclear power plants and starting to burn coal again. I mean, that just shows you how extreme the situation has gotten. And really the COP28 conference, and generally, I don't care for these things. That's not my cup of tea. But the takeaway from this one was strongly pro-nuclear. You've got, a couple dozen countries saying they're going to triple their nuclear power output over the next couple decades. That's a really, really big deal. And over the next couple decades, it's going to take time for these plants to be built and for the buyers to go out and start taking uranium off the market. But when you have a country like Japan doing an about face on their shutdown, those reactors are built, so that source of selling of excess supply in Japan becomes a new source of demand like that, not in years down the line. South Korea was also one that under a previous administration and talked about shutting down and now isn't. So I see, I'd rather invest on fundamentals and rather than just the storium, as our friend Rick likes to say. But in this case, you've got the technicals look great. The fundamentals have looked great for a year, but we do have the storium now really adding a tailwind. You know, I don't want to promise this or say, oh yeah, it's going to the moon. That's not my style. But if on top of the fundamentals, this flavor of the day narrative kicks in, uranium supply, it's just such a narrow pipe. It's like my friend Doug Casey likes to say, you know, the contents of the Hoover Dam trying to go through a garden hose. I'm not going to promise that, but, you know, that's a possibility in this tiny market.
Yeah, I just got a list. 60 reactors are under construction across the world. A further 110 are planned. I'd want to say, well, how does that balance with the ones being retired? But I don't know how many are retired. It says over the past 20 years, 107 reactors were retired. This is from world-nuclear.org. So it's not, I guess, an independent site, but it's amazing how many are in China.
Yes. And they're also ahead of the West on the small modular reactors, which is a really big deal as well. You know, those supply and demand forecasts, the models from the big engineering firms, even our own, because of the data out there, none of these models include SMRs, the small modular reactors, which are what's really generating a lot of excitement these days. We were just talking about how it's not happening in the West, but the Biden administration, I mean, this isn't some, you know, evil money-grubbing Republican. This is Joe Biden and the Democrats are pushing billions, not just millions, in subsidies and support for U.S. uranium and advanced nuclear in the U.S.
But where is that going? Meaning like the projects now, I'm not seeing that other than Georgia. I even look at this list and there's one in Georgia. It's the one in Georgia is the only one on this list that's being built.
Right. Well, so for advanced nuclear, that's going into research. That's why it's from actually hitting the ground in the U.S. But in terms of an about face and policy, I think that's very significant. The Chinese, I think, have already brought their first SMR online. The Canadians are ahead as well. They have an SMR project up there in the works. We're behind on this. But remember, this is on top of the regular old nuclear, if you will. The new nuclear is a tailwind on top of the old nuclear, which, according to the statistics you just cited, a lot more plants and reactors are being built than being retired. So it's an extra. You see what I'm saying? You know, even if it takes time, it's more demand that's not in the current models.
Yeah, I mean, I want nuclear to grow. I think there's going to be a major crisis in the U.S. in the next 5 years. As I don't know if you've seen, you're in Puerto Rico, but, you know, in New Jersey, ever since I've been seeing more and more Teslas on the road, I'm seeing more and more blackouts, more disturbances on the grid. And I'm very worried about the U.S. I think the U.S. needs to ramp up nuclear production immediately, and we need like a Georgia plant in every major region in the country, because the power that the grid is going to need to power these electric cars, we really don't know the full consequences.
I'm with you on that, and you know, you might think you've got expensive power in New Jersey and New York area, but Puerto Rico has, I think, the second most expensive electric power in the country, with the USVI being the only more expensive place. So, I'd love to see, you know, people say not in my backyard. Well, I'd love to see a nuclear power plant in my backyard here. I don't have a yard. I live in a tall building, but I would be happy to see a nuclear power plant on this island, which would be nearby anywhere they put it, because it's a small island.
Well, I grew up in Oyster Creek, New Jersey, and played in the Oyster Creek. So that might be what's wrong with me. But so we loved the nuclear plant. People had good jobs, good high paying jobs. It fueled the local economy. And it's really sad to see the plant be decommissioned. And it caused subsidized energy prices for years in the area.
But so you mentioned California. Even in California, there's significant political will now that just did not exist before to keep Diablo Canyon going. Like even Newsom has done an about face on that. So, you know, the times, they are a changing. And I think that's quite significant. I feel, you know, I'm not a Kramer type who pounds a big red buy button on TV. But for me, what you're seeing right now, this is me excited. This is about as close as I get to being like that. I sincerely think that it would take something on the order of a Chernobyl scale event to derail this investment thesis, because there's just not enough electricity.
Or Fukushima, I guess. You know, Fukushima.
Well, I'm not even sure if Fukushima, another Fukushima, would do it, because bear in mind, it was the tsunami that killed people. As far as has been determined, nobody's actually been killed by the nuclear incident there. And remember that there's a segment of our global population that thinks we're all going to die in 12 years if we don't go green instantly, like, right? The stop oil crowd. And right. So, you know, this is seen as an existential crisis. And if you're looking at life or death of the species, then extreme measures become justified. And even if that's nuclear. So it's a striking time.
I've been hearing that this whole extinction of the species thesis, peak oil, since I grew up in the 80s. So I don't trust any of it, but that's for another debate.
I remember in the 70s, and I remember there was the original King Kong movie from the 70s, which is not the original one from the 1920s. But it was the hero was an environmentalist geologist, and the evil bad guys were oil company execs, because they were, you know, it was the agenda of the day. It was loud and clear. Here we are. You know, we were supposed to not just have peak oil. We were supposed to be dying off in droves by now, according to the 70s projections. They're all wrong. But anyway, you know, what you and I might agree, Josh, you know, we're not the majority in the world. And I'm not saying that the green agenda is correct. Like it or not, it's popular. It's there. People want these electric cars. And the powers that be are on this. I mean, look, we had a hot war in Europe break out 2 years ago. And that didn't derail this agenda. You'd think that a war that was something that could literally turn into World War III might be an excuse for the powers that be to take a step back and say, oh, you know what? You know, we really believe in all this green stuff, but we've got a war here. So it's an emergency, and it's okay for us to, you know, take a breather on all this money and spend on windmills and whatnot. But that's the opposite of what they did. They said, oh, we got to double down here. This, you know, Putin cutting off the gas just shows that we have to have more windmills and more alternative energy. So if anything, that just shows you that, you know, right or wrong, this idea isn't going away. So I don't think I can change the whole world, Josh.
No, I mean, I love the uranium thesis.
But there you go.
I believed in it for 10 years.
From it, whether it's right or wrong, right?
Yeah, no, I know. But I was buying that stuff 10 years ago and nothing happened for years. So I kind of got poisoned against it.
I understand. My view is it's happening now. It's striking that even after Fukushima that, you know, it has come back at all. I think the sentiment, the pro-nuclear sentiment, is stronger now than it was pre-Fukushima, right? There was that one guy from Greenpeace, that Greenpeace founder, who was saying, you know, maybe we ought to reconsider nuclear. Now it's almost a majority view. Like, again, the COP28 thing. Dozens of countries saying they're going to triple nuclear. This is way beyond what we saw before.
How long does it take for me? So let's say I'm running for, I don't know, president or governor or whatever it is, and I want to build a nuclear plant in New Jersey. How long does it take for that to go live?
10 years. If you decide that today and get things going, that's a shooting from the hip kind of number.
We are going to have a major crisis in the U.S. with the drain on the grid with electric cars.
So I think so. And I think that crisis will motivate change. When people's power bills start going up, you know, they think their power bills are high now, but when they start going up 5x, 10x, as they did in Europe during the crisis, you know, after the invasion of Ukraine, the second invasion of Ukraine, right? You know, that's the sort of thing that motivates change. And, you know, I do think we'll see it. And by the way, I think that's not just, you know, pro-uranium. I think, you know, basically the not in my backyard, the NIMBY attitude is in direct conflict with A, reality, and B, the green agenda. You know, both of these are in conflict with this NIMBY kind of thinking. I think that will have to give way, and I think that'll be good for resource projects in the developed world, not just those other places.
Well, I know in New Jersey, growing up in New Jersey, we don't like windmills because it pollutes the view of the beach. So in New Jersey, there is a big, you know, blue state. There is no political will for windmills, although they put them in. Big turnoff of the general electorate, but nobody cares about nuclear. They embrace nuclear because we've had, you know, two thriving nuclear plants at one point. I forget how many total, but I know Oyster Creek was big and people loved it. So we have a question from the audience. Lily has a question. Folks, if you have a question for Lobo Tigray, you can message me your question and I will bring you up to ask him. We will talk about gold. We'll talk about Bitcoin. We're going to talk about uranium picks, stocks, investment theses that Lobo likes. So go ahead, Lily, with a comment or question.
Yeah, thank you. And Lobo, my question for you is really about what you think of the feasibility of what's happening in China, right? They've got this the thorium the thorium-fueled molten salt experimental reactor. And I know some of the resurgence there's like around nuclear in general has been around the molten salt reactors, right? But I know somebody that was in power for a long time, nuclear, who as soon as I, you know, sent this stuff to him a couple of years ago when we started seeing things from TerraPower, et cetera, sent me back, you know, the papers and what happened in, you know, the 60s, right, with the molten salt reactor. So I'm curious your thoughts around those things.
Sure. I get that question a lot, and I should stress that I'm not a nuclear engineer, so I can't give you a technical answer. As a market observer, though, I can say that this thorium story has been around for a long time. I don't see it, you know, one bit more advanced now than it was 10 years ago when it started spreading. Yes, I do know that there's some, you know, experimental action in China. But, you know, there was also a power plant in India that was supposed to be built that was capable of using thorium. And as far as I know, they haven't done that at all. So it's an idea that I think actually makes sense. The logic was, you know, there's this whole story about how actually thorium was a better fuel to begin with, but it wasn't so good for producing weapons. So the military industrial complex pushed the U.S. to go in the uranium direction. You know, all this stuff is interesting, but as an investor, as a speculator, it doesn't help me make my decisions today. So my thought is, you know, even if there are experiments now that have practical commercial implications down the road, we are, you know, years from that making a difference to the markets. Oh, and by the way, you didn't mention it, but thorium is much more abundant and it's cheap. So if the world switched to thorium-based reactors, it would be, you know, clearly bad news for uranium. But I think that, you know, we will absolutely see that coming. You'll go from talking about experiments to pilot plants to, you know, commercial ventures that will then have to promulgate this. And we'll see this coming, you know, years ahead of each one of these steps. I think we're at least 10 years from that, if it happens at all. You know, I'd like it to happen. And by the way, you can make uranium reactors that are molten salt designs as well. It doesn't have to be thorium, but I really like the molten salt. Like, that's the MSR of the SMRs. I think it's a brilliant design because it shuts itself off, right? If it runs away, it overheats the plug at the bottom, the salt runs out in the containment vessel, and it shuts down the nuclear reaction. So you could, you know, literally fall asleep at the switch there, and there would be no runaway. It would shut itself down. So I think the safety from that type of design is brilliant. I would like to see it proceed ahead. But as an investor in the space, I see it as having zero impact on my investment decisions today, none whatsoever. And probably there will be years of advance notice before that changes.
No, fantastic. Great answer. So yeah, let's talk about gold a little more. Uranium, we'll go into BTC. We'll go to other things you like. So uranium, what's the best exposure? We're not giving buy or sell recommendations, but what do you like? Do you like Camco? Do you like URA? Do you like...
I got to tell you, Josh, I don't give away free stock pick. Somebody should have warned you about this. So I'll
okay,
give you
that's fine. I'll I mean, you can tell things. Let's go. That's okay.
Let's be useful. Let's be useful. There's some guidance here because for anybody who thinks they missed the uranium boat last year, they saw the price go like that and the stocks move, I have some useful things to say. One is we've got a correction. You know, duh, that wasn't rocket science to predict that. And here it is. And so if you're thinking you missed the boat, that's the first and foremost thing is we are now seeing an opportunity here for those who are completely out of this space to at least make some first stakes, you know, into this space. So I do encourage that. As to what to buy, you know, that's the beauty of a correction. It's sort of like a time machine. When all the prices are going crazy, it's, you know, you don't want to succumb to FOMO and you know, buy high and hope to sell higher. But we now know which stocks. You can look at the charts over the last year, and any stock that went along the ride with uranium is something that's worth looking at on the dip or on the correction. Any stock that, you know, uranium went vertical and the stock barely budged, that's telling you something about that company. You know, maybe that's not the one. Okay, it looks like it's a cheap bargain maybe, but maybe there's a reason why it's a bargain. The market is telling you something useful there. The other thought I would throw in is just, you know, not all investors or speculators are the same, or not all investors want to be speculators. If you like the uranium thesis, but you don't want the added risk of, you know, companies that can make money or fail to make money, or explorers that can fail to make a discovery, that sort of thing, we do have various ETFs. So you can more cautiously just bet on the metal itself. That is a lower risk way to go. If you're somewhere in between, you know, the larger players, more advanced companies are, you know, obviously less risky than betting on some moose pasture exploration outfit that is hoping to make a discovery. So hopefully those are some useful tips.
So uranium at 50, then it goes up to 100, then it falls below 100. Where do you think it's going?
Yeah, the honest answer is I don't know how long or how deep the correction will be. If we weren't in the situation where the big dogs were having trouble ramping up production, I actually would have thought the correction would have been steeper. I would have been saying, I know I did say that we could easily see a correction back down to 70 or 80, the so-called incentive price level. It would have been easy to see that. I would have thought the $100 price level would have been an overshoot. But since we now have supply the market was counting on, no longer there, no longer coming online, I've changed my outlook. I actually think that this plus or minus $100 level is showing a lot of strength. We're consolidating here. I don't see this as a market that's rolled over and headed much lower. Now, I may be wrong. This is me going out on a limb with you, Josh. I see this as a consolidation phase. You know, whether it's above 100 or a couple bucks under 100 isn't a big deal. The fact that it's holding anywhere near this level, I think, is really significant. There's a significant bid on this market. People wouldn't be paying anywhere near triple digits for these pounds if they didn't have to, if they didn't need them. So there's a need out there. There's a supply constraint. And I think that gets worse going ahead into this year. So I don't know how long the correction lasts, but I see it as an opportunity right now. If I didn't own any uranium stocks right now, I'd be looking at getting into the market. We're recording on a Friday. I'd be looking at getting into the market next week.
And we did a show, I don't know, 6 months, a year ago, talking about uranium, talking about metals, talking about likening this period of the market to the 70s, where there was market uncertainty, you know, particularly 73, 74, the correction of 22 reminded me of. And if you look at this, that kind of period of the market, we're in the 70s to about the early 80s, the stock market didn't do anything, but natural resource players did well, things that went up when inflation went well. And to me, that's a bullish case for uranium and also probably for gold as well. Let's talk about gold now. Where do you think gold's going?
Well, I had predicted new all-time highs before the end of this year. And here we are, March 1st, and we're already seeing that. I think the market's closed now. I'm looking at 2091.60 on MarketWatch. Kitco usually has a different contract that they follow, so a little bit lower perhaps. But that counts as a new nominal all-time high already. But I have to say, this isn't anywhere near what I'm looking for. We're up for the wrong reasons, if you will. You know, almost exactly the wrong reasons. Today, we had some economic data that made it look a little bit more likely that the Fed might cut sooner than the markets had been fearing. So you could see this wasn't just gold, right? You could see all three of the major stock indices in the green. It was, this was a happy, happy, joy, joy day on Wall Street. And ironically, gold goes up because inflation is seeming like the Fed is winning, right? It's creating economic hardship and difficulties, which is going to bring inflation down. So, you know, maybe I'm completely crazy and I don't know anything, Josh, and nobody should listen to me. But you know, gold's doing great. And this in front of, I think we're still in for this hard landing. I'm still on team hard landing. I think, I don't know how far you want to go down the different rabbit holes here. But I think the so-called strong labor market is not as strong as it looks. And I just think we're going through the ringer here. And even if it's not a hard landing, a soft landing is still the mainstream view. And a soft landing is still a recession. People like to say, oh, that means, oh, everything's going to be fine. No, a soft landing just means that the recession won't do that much harm. But it's still a recession. And gold historically always does really well in recessions. So we're looking at the mainstream, not just crazy Lobo Tigre, but the mainstream view on Wall Street is for a recession. And we've got, you know, $2,000, $2,100 gold in front of that. You know, it's I don't want to do too much arm waving here, but just say that gold goes up 10% this year. 10% from where we are is almost $210 higher. You know, imagine the headlines if that happens.
And a massive rally from October, like epic rally. For those of you just joining me, I'm Josh Chulinski, the financial quarterback. We're live right now on Twitter Spaces. We've got about 100 people in. Make sure you share the room. Follow Lobo Tigre, follow me so you can get more of these shows that we're doing. I have a podcast, The Financial Quarterback. This will also, the edited version will go on the Financial Quarterback podcast. Make sure you download my new Reimagined podcast. We're also on WOR, one of New York's biggest talk radio stations, 7:10 a.m. So Lobo, you mentioned hard landing, soft landing. I want to go down the rabbit hole. But I have a quick anecdote that signals to me we're going into a recession, but I don't know when. I'll say next year. Just I have a theory that it might be next or you know, November, December. Donald Trump wins in November, and then all of a sudden the media says, "Oh, we're in a recession." And then everybody starts selling. If I was a betting man, that's what I think. I think we got about, you know, 7-8 more months of this, and then, you know, people start selling off. I get a call. I'm in Hawaii in the airport. My Google exec friend, he's not an executive at Google. He's an executive at an SEO company. And he says, Google's in trouble. And I could be wrong. You know, I'm worried that Google Ads, so you got one of the Magnificent Seven in significant trouble. Basically, Microsoft Copilot is making Google search almost obsolete, if you know how to use it. Google really hasn't any innovations. They've had bungled Gemini rollout, and then they're giving people $1,000 ad spends, which tells me they're hurting for ad revenue. And marketing is the first thing that businesses cut as they see a recession on the horizon. What do you think about that anecdote? And then take us down the rabbit hole of the landings.
Yeah, I think that fits in with a lot of other such things. It's not just anecdotal data. I can't say that I have a statistical analysis of the percentage of companies, you know, on the S&P 500 that are offering weaker guidance. But, you know, after 2022, there was a lot of the forward-looking statements from these companies were cut. So we had Biden, we had beats in 2023, but that was from reduced layers. Except for AI stuff recently, we've had, you know, beats on lower guidance. Well, guess what? That's still not a sign of great strength in the economy. And if you look at other bellwethers, we've got, you know, FedEx, we've got Walmart, we've got all kinds of, you know, from core infrastructure businesses to retail businesses, retail, where supposedly the consumer is so strong, you know, guiding down or at least cautiously looking forward into 2024. There are a lot of indicators out there that show recession. We've got, you know, federal revenue is one. We've got, well, the leading economic indicators themselves. We've had a manufacturing recession. I think we just got the 16th month in a row of contraction in U.S. manufacturing. We did have an earnings recession. You know, and the fashionable thing on Wall Street now is just to call this a rolling recession. Because, well, if we have a strong labor market, then it can't be a recession by definition. Well, that's actually not true. And the 2/4 of GDP is also not, you know, technically a recession. It's just a common sort of rule of thumb. My view, my sort of umbrella view here is that there's a lot in the U.S. economy that is visibly in recession. Oh, we've had a commodities recession too, by the way. And the strong labor market, it always, you know, it's interesting. It's not just me or crazy libertarian anarchist types who are critical of the government. You listen to the mainstream guys who know something about these things. And when they look under the covers of the blowout jobs report, they say, well, you know, but there's these signs of weakness here. And that's from people who are drinking the Kool-Aid. Even they can see these signs of trouble. My view, there's two key points here. One is that we saw this post-pandemic labor hoarding. You know, companies had such a hard time hiring people that they're afraid to fire people even if they don't need them. And I understand, I understand both the companies and I understand the people. Nobody wants to get fired. I'm not trying to get people fired, or I'm not looking for misery here. But the reality is, if you're a company that you know, holds on to workforce that you don't need, then that's actually a bad business decision. You're doing it because you're afraid you can't hire these people back. You increase the chances that you're going to face insolvency. Instead of firing 10 or 20% to remain strong, you might end up firing 100% because you missed it and now you're in trouble. I think that there's a fraught risk here. You know, this apparent strength in the labor market, while you have all these other indicators showing recession, actually makes labor extremely vulnerable going forward if there's a wake-up, aha moment of like, oh my gosh, we don't need all these people. We're about to go bankrupt. You know, we gotta drop the axe. Now, the other thing is, I said two key points. So one is, I think labor hoarding has distorted the labor market. And everybody keeps talking about how this is the pillar. This laborer consumer is still spending because they still got jobs. Well, if that goes out the window or breaks down in any serious way, I think that's a big deal. The other thing is just to take a step back and look at the history of Fed rate tightening cycles. It was, in all cases, except arguably 1994, leads to a recession. The so-called long and variable lags, famously long and variable, depending on which numbers you look at, that long and variable averages 18 to 27 months. And we are in a period of, you know, not just extraordinary times, we're in uncharted waters. The closest comparable to the pandemic shutdown was 100 years ago, and the world economy was completely different then. So we've never really been in this place. If I'm right about the post-pandemic labor hoarding distorting the U.S. economy, then it's no surprise for the long and variable lags to be long. So just statistically, the people who say, and there are people on mainstream finance, serious Wall Street professionals saying, well, if we haven't had a recession by now, we're not going to have one. Simply statistically, historically, that's wrong. If that, you know, we're sort of getting into the middle of that range now. If we haven't had one by this summer, by June, July, then it's actually starting to get long. Not yet too late. You really couldn't conclude that if we haven't had one by now, we're not getting one until the end of this year. But after the summer, it'll start being late. There will be a much longer than usual long and variable lag. But we're not even there yet. So it's simply wrong to say, hadn't shown up yet, not going to happen.
Didn't we technically have one in 22 with the two bad quarters in a row? I know that was kind of glossed over. You know,
people call that a technical recession, but that's based on GDP, which I think is a deeply flawed number to begin with. I think that concept economically makes very little sense. And also GDP is strongly influenced by the inflation adjustment, which is based on CPI, which is another, you know, deeply flawed, maybe if not in concept, you know, Austrian economists would say even in concept, but let's say in execution, the way they measure it you know, if, even if you go with John Williams and try to measure it the way the government itself used to measure it, is greatly different from how they measure it now. So, you know, it's sort of a lie built on quicksand or something.
So how would you view it?
If I'm going to be critical of GDP in general, which I am, then it would be inconsistent of me to say, oh, look, two negative quarters of GDP. So that means we had a recession. So I just rather discount GDP in
general. So what would you say would be what is the metric you would use for a recession?
I would look at, to borrow from our dear friend, Jerome Powell, the totality of the evidence. Like, we're talking about this rolling recession. I just ticked off five different things that you could argue we have been in a recession on already, with the exception of the laborer, spender, consumer. So when that happens, my view is actually we are in a recession. There's enough in the economy, that there's enough weakness in the economy, there's enough cooling in the economy that arguably we are in a recession. That's less controversial if we say it about the globe, but I would say that about the US. And the concentration of happy, happy, joy, joy on Wall Street and the free stimmy checks that make people feel wealthier than they are masks this. But the reality is, I think, you know, more things are bad than good in the United States. And if I'm right, and the few things that look good start tipping over, then remember, like, even by this official, the official NBER recognition of recession, that always happens after the fact. It's 2-3 quarters later, they say, oh, you know what? We are in a recession and it started 6 months ago. So, I don't have one number that I can say, oh, here's it.
I agree with you. I think we're in a recession, but I think the wealth effect of high real estate prices and high stock prices, high 401ks, make people think we are not in a recession, but I think the stock market is distinct from the economy. And
absolutely. And this is why Biden's so unpopular. He and his minions keep going on TV and saying, oh, the economy's great. But that's not what people experience. And here's one way of looking at it, Josh. I see it as like a bimodal distribution, like a camel's back with two humps, right? And so the people who do have exposure to the Magnificent Seven and the people who are wired into the system, you know, they're doing great, or they feel like they're doing great. So there's all this wealth effect that you mentioned over here on this end. But the people on the bottom rungs of the socioeconomic ladder, they're not getting any of that benefit. They're going into the store and they're seeing prices that are plus or minus 20% higher than they were a couple of years ago. And the products and the packages are smaller, right? So they're not feeling it. And there's more of those people on the lower end of the distribution than the higher end. So you can take these two camel humps and average them together and say, oh, look, the average looks great. But the reality is there's a lot of people on the lower end of that distribution that are not feeling it. They're not loving it. And I'm not here to be political, about whose responsibility this is. There's a lot going on. And honestly, it started before Biden.
Yeah, if you look at, I went to Hawaii a few weeks ago and go to Kauai and go to a grocery store and there's two workers. And you go, what happened to all the locals? They all left. They went to Las Vegas. So they're calling Las Vegas like the eighth Hawaiian island or the fifth Hawaiian island now, because they just couldn't afford. Because after COVID, Kauai in particular, you know, it's just infected by a lot of Californians who stayed. And, you know, they just left. That's why Josh Green, the governor of Hawaii, told people who weren't from there to sell their houses to locals so they could afford it or something in Maui. And that's kind of illustrative. People are going on vacation, but two workers. Imagine two workers at the grocery store and like lines out the wazoo.
Yeah, no. I've seen that here in Puerto Rico. I had a friend who had a hotel here and he just couldn't get anybody to work in the hotel. And you know, because it's difficult times to begin with. So you can't just jack up your room rates 2 or 3 times. People won't pay them, especially you know, in the COVID period, in the more intense COVID period, people didn't want to travel. So people wanted to be paid like $50 an hour to clean rooms. But you can't charge more than $100 a night. It just doesn't work.
Oh, exactly. So we have some questions from the audience. Dave, go ahead.
Hey, Josh. I don't know if you remember. You probably don't recognize.
No, I remember you. I know your voice very well. Hey, Dave.
Yeah, man, from Clubhouse. Good to see you on Twitter or on X. And I always liked your rooms back then. You know, you bring a very broad but a very detailed financial analysis. So as you see, I'm a big crypto guy. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin? Where do we go? Where does it go from here?
Thanks so much and great to reconnect with you. Go ahead, Lobo. I'll have you answer that.
All right. Everybody get out your rotten tomatoes here. First and foremost, I just tweeted this today. I am not anti-cryptocurrencies. As a libertarian, I think that the advent of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies was actually a rational market response to government mismanagement of money supply. The governments of the world have been criminal. And I mean that literally, not just rhetorically exaggerated. I mean that literally. I think it's criminal what they've done to money. The fiat money system is a mechanism, I think, for those in power to rob from the populace in general, extracting value from them through surreptitious inflation. So in that context, where you can't get the governments to reform their criminal system that they benefit from, what else can you do but go completely outside? So I think the advent of cryptos is fantastic. I cheered when Bitcoin came along. That said, I don't own any cryptos
right
now.
Here come the tomatoes.
I played with it. No. There come the tomatoes, right? You know, I've played with it. Actually, I tripled my money on some Ethereum back in the day. But I cannot gain confidence in the valuation of any of these. Like what should be Bitcoin be worth? And people say, oh, there's only be 21 million of them forever. It's inflation proof. And I know that there's answers to most of my objections. I just haven't been persuaded. But briefly, you know, okay, only 21 million Bitcoin, but Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin 2, Bitcoin 3, Bitcoin 7, if they're functionally the same, you know, I get that there's strength in the network, that Bitcoin was first, but these are theoretical arguments. We don't have thousands of years of experience with cryptocurrencies and how they work out and whether the first mover advantage really does make one crypto to rule them all in the end, like the ring of Sauron in Mordor, as some of these Bitcoin maxis seem to think is going to happen. And there's really persuasive arguments in the other side.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
You're referring to CBDCs, correct?
Separate question. I think CBDCs are incredibly scary. So my point with, if I just can wrap up with the cryptos, I'm not the guy to tell you where it's going to go. I don't know what it's worth. I'm worried about, even if the blockchain itself, it really is unhackable, which is a difficult pill for me to swallow. The exchanges and things that people use, most people don't, you know, they don't have their own wallet and so on. So there's a great deal of vulnerability here. I just see too much uncertainty there for me to invest on it. And you know what? If Bitcoin becomes the money of the future, you know, 20, 30 years from now, all the fiat currencies go away and the world is all trading in Bitcoin, fine. I'll adopt it. There'll be plenty of room for me in that world as well. I don't feel a need to bet now on what's eventually going to happen with cryptos decades down the road. The central bank digital currencies, oh, brother, that is seriously scary. I in the same way that the governments of the world found that fiat currencies were a great way to be able to plunder people without them noticing, I think CBDCs take that to the next level and beyond, where it's not just, oh, well, we can control the money supply more easily. Well, if you can turn somebody's individual wallet on and off, oh, you know, just like this thing that happened with the truckers in Canada, where they could go in and punish people who donated to support the truckers there financially and shut down their bank accounts and things. You know, CBDCs make that infinitely more powerful. not just targeting or sanctioning an individual, but like controlling an individual's behavior. I know I'm not the first person to say this. I'm just repeating things that I've heard, but I get it that the technology would enable them to say, no, you've had enough red meat this week. Your credit cards are not going to be able to be used for buying any more red meat this week.
Yeah, you know, your cows have farted too much.
That's right. All that stuff. This is seriously scary. And honestly, I don't know how to stop it.
You stop it with the next generation. You take your kids out of government schools where they brainwash children to become little socialists, because they're not going to then agree to regenerative farming and all these practices. I actually found that regenerative farming of cows is now good for the environment and sequesters more carbon. So,
well, do you remember, Josh, when paper bags were evil because we're cutting down trees? Now we want paper bags because plastic is evil, right? You know, it's funny how these things come around in
and
circles.
Now I'm banned in New Jersey. You can't use plastic or paper. So I said, well, why don't we have everybody use tapioca? So literally when I go to the store, because I'm so incensed by this, I now go on Instacart all the time and just have the things delivered to my house and they get the bags for you. And so you're now filling landfills with these supposedly, you know, 100 use bags. I have thousands of these bags. And then some idiot in New Jersey said, well, we're going to pass a law where you have to reuse the bags. Well, the plastic bags were way more efficient, and I actually used them. I did reuse them to actually as like waste paper trash bags.
You know, it's cheaper to buy pay the 5 or 10 cents for one of these reusable bags and use that for a trash bag if you have a small amount of trash than to buy a box of trash bags. But sorry, let me rewind, because you said something there that I think is important. And I'm not trying to be doom and gloom necessarily here, but I think the CBDC threat is something within the next 5 years. Whereas educating your children is depending on how old they are, you know, a 5 to 15 to 20 year effort. So there's a problem there with getting the next generation to save us. If we could get the current, you know, millennials.
I have no hope
and
for
generation.
That generation. Why? No hope for that generation.
A lot of millennials like cryptos, right? They get the anti-inflation aspect of it. There's a fair number of them that get the privacy benefits that can be accrued from the cryptos. You know, it's there's something out there. And maybe the crypto crowd, yes, censorship is bad. Maybe the crypto crowd can help us here to teach and get some significant opposition here. If you could get the younger generations to fight it, maybe there's a chance, but I don't see it as an issue with them yet, Josh.
I would distinguish the Bitcoin crowd from the crypto crowd.
Josh, there's more like three crowds. There's three major crowds. There's the Bitcoin crowd, there's the Ethereum crowd, and there's the Solana crowd. I think there's three blocks. And then you've got the, you know, the altcoins, which there's a few powerful ones there too with a decent sized market cap.
I would distinguish it from sort of the Bitcoin maximalist crowd, the altcoin kind of shitcoin crowd, and there's many people who believe in many different things for many different reasons. So Casey, I want to change subjects a little bit. You got me thinking, because Casey's a Bitcoiner, isn't he? And you were mentored by him.
Yeah, that was an interesting about face on his part, because he was anti-Bitcoin for a long time, and somebody persuaded him that no, there is an argument here for Bitcoin's unique position and strength in this space and its future as money. And as an anarchist, it would appeal to him. As I was saying, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am.
Right? It's as a market response to government gross mismanagement of the money supply, the business of money, that lifeblood of the economy. The government's, you know, buggering that in such a big way. It makes sense. And for anybody who's critical of government's mismanagement, I understand that. Again, like conceptually, I'm on board with this. I'd love to see the day where we're trading in secure digital currencies of any kind. I'd like to see one really in circulation that's backed by physical reality like gold or something like that. But my long-term approach here, though, is let the market decide rather than me say what will be and rather than the government say what must be. I'd like to see the market work out. What is the best form of money? And I'm happy to go with whatever wins in that case. My question for me, though, is what do I do right now as a speculator? You know, do I want to bet on Bitcoin going up from here? Well, we're close enough to the halving that, you know, maybe woulda, coulda, shoulda. I should have bought it 6 months ago. But now I'm very reluctant to get on something that's going like this. I'd rather wait for after the halving and before the next halving. And, you know, by then we'll
I got you. So let's change topics a little bit. We got gold. We talked about gold. We talked about uranium. Talked about a little Bitcoin. What other opportunities do you like to speculate on, generally speaking?
Well, so generally or broadly, I really like real estate. I like a number of things. But my expertise, my specialty, my experience as an investor is in commodities and mostly metals and mining. So in that wheelhouse, if we're right about this recession becoming undeniable in the US and getting worse before it gets better, I think, well, two things. One, if we're right about the recession, there'll be spectacular sale prices available on necessary metals that, you know, civilization depends upon, like copper and other metals out there. So I would look for that as an opportunity. And the other thing is that if we're right about this recession, I think the powers that be unleash the money helicopters again. I think we're going to see, you know, they will not allow the recession. If they see it starting to happen, they'll try to nip it in the bud. If it comes up faster than they can get on it, they will just respond with even more money. We've already seen them establish that no fault of their own is enough reason to send somebody a stimmy check. And a recession is no fault of anybody's own. So I do think we're going to see the money floodgates opening. And I think that's going to be very inflationary after the fact. I think that's going to be extremely bullish for all commodities, particularly the necessary industrial metals and minerals after the fact. I'm very bullish on copper and oil, first and foremost, after the recession does its worst. And I don't want to buy either of them if I think, you know, things are going to get worse.
So you don't really like copper or oil now?
I like them, but wouldn't buy them. You know, I'm waiting for this buying opportunity. And the reason why I'm willing to do that is because let's say I'm wrong about the recession and, you know, Biden kisses the boo-boo, everything gets better, and the economy takes off into a new reflationary boom here. Well, I don't think oil doubles overnight. I don't think copper just takes off for the moon and never looks back. You know, they'll carve out a bottom and they'll start heading up again, and there'll still be time to get on that bandwagon as it goes forward over the next few years. That next reflationary boom would likely last for years. So if I'm looking at something where, okay, I won't hit the bottom, right? I can't time the bottom, but I'll still be able to benefit from a multi-year bull market. And there's also this near-term possibility of being able to buy the same thing for 50% less. Like, these are my choices. I can maybe buy for 50% less. And if not, maybe I buy for 10 or 20% more. But those odds say, well, I'm going to wait. I want to wait for that sale. And if I don't get it, okay, I'll pay the 10 or 20% more.
No, fantastic. We're with Lobo Tigre. If you're just joining us, make sure you follow him. Follow me. We have tons of great guests like Lobo. So you'll want to subscribe to our Twitter spaces so you can be updated on it. So I want to kind of change subjects again, because you've spent a lot of time working with Doug Casey, Rick Rule for a number of years. What did you learn from them? What was the best lesson you learned from each?
Well, yeah, and it's funny. They're different personalities with such similar views on so many things. There are actually a number of things from Doug, but one of the most important lessons, and this isn't originally a Doug thing, it's actually, I think, Ben Graham, an intelligent investor, first articulated this, and that is that there's a difference between price and value. And I'm not a believer in the efficient market hypothesis. I think experience shows us exactly the opposite. Markets get irrationally exuberant, to throw another well-worn phrase out there. And it's because markets get overbought and oversold that there's opportunities for speculators. It's because value and price diverge. And by the way, you can make money going short as well as going long. But if something that's necessary, like copper or uranium, is selling for less than it costs to mine the stuff, you're either not going to have that necessary thing or the price is going to go up. And so that divergence is the opportunity for a disciplined speculator who's willing to be a contrarian, go against the herd, right, to make money. That is the essence. Like if you could boil, it's hard to boil a complicated character like Doug down to one thing. But if there's an essence of the Casey method, it's that. And, you know, people call him a contrarian, and he is. But it's not just because he's contrary. Well, in Doug's case, maybe it is because he's contrary. But the idea as an investor, you know, you want to buy low, sell high, or short high, you know, cover low, right? It's not about being a contrarian. It's that there's a difference between price and value. The market is wrong about the price, and this has to change. So that's the main thing from Doug. With Rick, oh gosh, there's so many brilliant things that I've gotten from Rick. But I think perhaps this may sound not sexy, not fun, not the quote or the, you know, the headline for your video here, but really discipline, patience, method, emotional intelligence. Rick is so calm, so cool, even when things are going against him. It's admirable as a human being that he can just have the intestinal fortitude to do that. But I sincerely think that's the basis of his fortune and Doug's as well. Like Doug's, maybe this wild and crazy anarchist libertarian contrarian guy, Rick is the utterly opposite in the way of like total cool cucumber, but doing a similar thing because it's make money on process. It's like, this is the system. This is how it works. If we stick with the game plan, we'll come out ahead. And just listen to any Rick Rule interview. You know, I sound like Kramer compared to him. You know, he's just so calm. And I've seen him off stage. I've seen him with a few glasses of wine in him. He's always like that. He never gets excited and jumps up and down. And I think that's an enormous part of his success.
And I probably should have asked this question before that question, but how did you get started in the investment newsletter business? And for those of you just joining us, we're with Lobo Tigre. And what website can people find out more about your work? Independentspeculator.com?
One and only. And I'll answer your question. I'll just say, since you brought that up, there's a free weekly digest that we have. It's an email. There's no archive online. So if you want to see what I think for free, sign up for that email. And the one simple promise I have is that I won't spam you. I may be right or wrong about some things, but I promise you won't get a flood of daily advertisements if you sign up for that email list. Anyway, to answer the question, it's kind of funny. I got here by being the black sheep of my family, being my own family's version of the rabble-rousing, black leather jacket-clad atheist anarchist rebel there. So I met Doug a long time ago, early days of the internet. I had sort of something like a pirate radio station in the early days of the internet. And somebody introduced me to Doug and I interviewed him. I was doing a show like you and I interviewed him. And it was like meeting my long lost brother. For an hour, I asked him questions and all of his answers were basically what I would say, except much more erudite and with a lot of Roman history thrown in, a lot of experience on the markets, things that I didn't know. But on principle, it was just an amazing meeting of minds. It was so much fun. We remained friends after that. And then when Doug and his then partner, David Galland, founded Casey Research in 2004, 20 years ago now, they knew me as a writer. At the time, I'd never studied geology. I'd never bought a stock. I didn't know what a warrant was. It was completely green. But they knew me as a competent writer who did what I said I would do, somebody they could trust. So they formed Casey Research. They hired a receptionist. They hired a marketing guy. And then they hired me as an editor to help with the writing. It was a third hire they made. So that's how I got started. And then I just learned very quickly. I loved it. It turns out, you know, I was a kid who collected rocks. I never studied geology at a university. But now I've got 20 years of kicking rocks in the field with world-class geologists, and I've learned a thing or two, and I love it. So I've just been having so much fun. I got paid to hang out with Doug and people like that. I got paid to travel around the world and look at all these mines and projects and things and meet all these people. And I love to write. I got paid to write. So it was like the dream job for me, and I had so much fun. And sorry, just not to wax too rhapsodical on this, but I think this is actually a really important point. If you love something, if you're really passionate about something, then you're that very interest, it's a big tailwind behind your success. When you want to learn something, you'll learn it 10 times better. You don't have to repeat something to me about geology because I wanted to know the answer. You don't have to pound it into my head. I think that's something that investors should keep in mind. If there's something that excites you, if there's something that motivates you, if you're really keen on hard assets and gold and silver, then finding out more about how they're produced and things, that's great. You will become a better investor in the related stocks because it interests you. Or if you're big into Bitcoin, find out more about how the blockchain works. You know, you don't have to become a programmer, but get into the technicalities of it. You'll make better decisions than I could because I'm still ignorant on that one.
Yeah, that's a great point. So many people are into Bitcoin, they haven't yet actually made transactions on the blockchain and stuff like that. So that's a great tip. So does he still, I think I read something years ago, did they invest in Nicaragua? I remember reading some report, didn't they get involved in Nicaraguan real estate? And that was interesting that...
Yeah, that wasn't Doug. That was an Agora affiliate.
That was one of those guys. Bonner, but it's funny, guys. Like Bonner and was Casey the one in Argentina?
Yep. Though Bill lives down there too. I was up visiting Doug in Cafayate, where he has his real estate thing there, his little golf gulch. And we went up to the museum at Colomé up the hill from there. And I ran into Bill Bonner up there. And it's funny, you know, at the time, Agora had all these different tentacles around the world, all these different publication things. I understood they had something like 3,000 employees at the time. And I run into Bill, and he's there with his wife, and he looks at me and he recognizes me. And he turns to his wife and he says, "This is Louis James. He writes for us." I was really impressed. Like I had seen him like once before. You know, Doug's a friend. I had just only met Bill once and he remembered me. So, you know, these are interesting people. So yeah, Doug's thing was in Argentina. He's now mostly in Uruguay. He has a large estancia there. And, you know, he hates the airport Nazis and he doesn't like traveling so much. So it takes a lot to get Doug to fly to one of these conferences these days. You kind of got to go down there if you want to see him.
Yeah, I remember that, you know, so many years ago, they were pushing Nicaragua. And if you only bought Nicaragua when they told you to, now it's huge. Now it's like, My buddy trying to sell me a place in Nicaragua. Just land is 70 grand. It used to be like 700 bucks for an acre.
I went to that development once, and it is beautiful. And it's in that corner of Nicaragua where the waves seem to be just right for surfers. So it was a surfer haven. Yeah.
So, and it's only going to get bigger. So yeah, this was a lot of fun. Folks, if you have any final questions, we will ask them. Otherwise, we'll wrap up the interview. I want to thank you, Lobo, for joining us. Everybody, make sure you follow Lobo on Twitter. And anything you would like to plug today, website, book?
No, I think the free letter, no spam, I promise, is enough. And I want to thank you and Josh, the audience, your audience, anybody out there, because I was late. It's completely my fault. So if I disappointed you by being a no-show at the time, I apologize. If you came back and gave me a second chance, thank you for listening. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, we had hundreds of people in and out. So good job. Thank you so much, Lobo. And folks, if you want to learn more about his work, go to independentspeculator.com. Make sure you follow me and him on Twitter, as I'll be doing more of these rooms with great guests asking the things you want me to ask. So thanks so much, Lobo.